welcome back to Shattering This. Glenn has mentioned offering people false hope, which is the essence of politics, the essence of religion, is as big a crime, if not a bigger crime, than providing a warning for something that isn't going to happen. The Chicken Little syndrome. I happen to agree with him. And it is so prevalent today. You know, you listen to the president's speeches, you listen to comments made in the media, you listen to the comments of Yellen, the Federal Reserve chieftain, and it's nothing but smoke and mirrors, false hope. The president ran on the campaign, change you can believe in. Of course, he didn't change anything, and if you believed him, you were played for a fool. You know, he reported how thrilled he was on the Affordable Care Act because they had signed up 7 million individuals. Didn't bother to tell you that his statements in the past, particularly during his State of the Union address when it was 6 million, had been fact-checked, and the actual number that are beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act is in the hundreds of thousands. Because they show someone as having signed up even if they haven't paid. It'd be like a retail store saying they sold something that no one went through the cash register to buy. They included individuals that bought insurance packages at higher rates that formerly had insurance packages at the lower rates. And they counted all the numbers of people that had Medicaid or Medicare available to them prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, so that they weren't incremental as a result of the Affordable Care Act, even though they were claimed as beneficiaries of it. And then to add insults to all of this, he goes off and tells the world how successful this program has been. And what's interesting, of course, is that now the government, to give away entitlements, that's what the Affordable Care Act is. It's designed to cause young people and healthy people and responsible people to pay a lot more for their insurance so that people who are not responsible can get insurance for vastly less than what it should cost them. And there's no report on did that equation work? Did people overpay for insurance that are healthy to subsidize those that are not? Or is the whole system bankrupt? And what they also did not report is that for the first time ever, the U.S. government ran tens of millions of dollars worth of ads, maybe even the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of ads, to encourage people to take advantage of a government handout. In fact, a television ad said, even if you're a family and you make $91,000 a year, you're entitled to government subsidies for your health insurance. So the plan is so enticing that they had to advertise giving away taxpayer money. You know, false hope. Smoke and mirrors.
There's another false hope example that I'd like to bring up.
Sure.
If I may, a minute.
Sure.
There's a fellow who makes the rounds of the talk radio circuit, all different hosts, all different networks, who is known for his work regarding the manipulations of economies for state, county and local entities, governments, through the use of their comprehensive annual financial reports.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the national level, he talks about the Federal Registry is used for, manipulating things. And he's remarkably intelligent and he's remarkably detailed. He's a great economic pathologist in terms of describing the disease. He's got the anatomy and physiology of the horrible beast all figured out in ways that most of us don't comprehend. Yeah. However, He, mm-hmm. and he has a supreme cockiness about this, you know, he presents it like, it's, oh yeah, not a problem. Our earnings are fine. Like everything's going to be fine once everybody realizes how much money there is. And he's going to make presentations to congressmen and senators. Mm-hmm. And then he turns around with this supremely, after all this amazingly erudite investigation of the mm-hmm. machinations and manipulations, turns around and, you know, talks about how, you know, he can all he has to do is, like, is that he's going to appeal to the profit motive, you know, of these people and get them to, I mean, we could totally eliminate taxation if we just did this especially with the investments. And, you know, that he's going to appeal to these people in high places and prove that, you know, this can be mutually beneficial for both them and the people and that, you know, this can all be come out wonderfully. The man has no concept. I mean, this is a supremely naive idea. If he really thinks
of course.
That profit motive is, you know, of what evil and wickedness really are and what and the implications of sociopathy in these people mm-hmm. and actual spiritual evil. You know, mm-hmm. it's like so naive.
So what you're citing here is the thing that always frustrates me. There's lots of people out there that are very smart. And there's lots of people out there that know many things. You know, if you speak or listen to an expert on defense, they know much about America's war-making capability. If you listen to a person speak about economics, they know much about economic theory. But the problem is that most people who are smart and who know today have not been able to exercise good judgment. They're not discerning. They have not been able to make the transition from knowing to understanding. And I think many people, if not most people, have been crippled in this process. Now, I'm going to tell you that my experience is that the vast majority of people the world over are simply ignorant because they're apathetic. They're not willing to invest the time necessary to learn the truth. And I'm not speaking to our audience. You wouldn't be listening to this program unless you were really interested in evidence and reason. So, but there are a lot of people out there that just don't bother to know. They'll wallow in opinions because opinions are the closest thing they will ever find to evidence. But then there are those, like the gentleman that you spoke of, who are extremely knowledgeable and articulate. With detailed information about their particular subject, but then are incapable of making forming a conclusion that provides any understanding. And I think to a large degree, Glenn, this is a product of perhaps the last 50 years of education in this country where political correctness has become the moral code of our academic institutions, and the greatest sin in political correctness is to be judgmental, to exercise good judgment, to be discerning, to judge between things, to be able to make a conclusion as opposed to tolerate everything. And so maybe it's this individual can be smart, can be knowledgeable, but is incapable of processing it.
He's the master pathologist. He can describe every micron, you know, looking through an electron microscope, every micron of the evils of the economic systems. But then, it's just the naivete that if simply present totally wicked, unreasonable people with this idea of a mutually beneficial solution, that they'll jump at it. They'll go for it, you know. Well, you know, it's funny resources, you know. They use the attitude of the stereotypical pipe smoking, tire kicking, and know-it-all engineer of days gone by.
And the reality is that the U.S. economy can't be fixed. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about it. It's important for us to know what's wrong with it. It's important for folks to know how we got into this place. It's important to know why and how politicians and bankers are blowing smoke to keep people believing in the system that is already bankrupt, and how quantitative easing pushes the bankruptcy down the field a bit, but will cause it to be much more catastrophic. It's important to know these things because it tells people they ought not place their hope or their trust or their belief in their government because it has already failed, and that failure is going to become catastrophic. So it's important to tell people this without giving them the false hope of fixing it. You know, when you listen to so many talk shows, Glenn, the vast preponderance of radio talk shows are conservative political individuals or very religious and conservative political individuals all talking to their audience about how they need to get control of Congress, they need to rally the vote, they need to condemn Democrats and prop up Republicans so that they can fix this country. And it's false hope. All of it. I mean, the Rush Limbaughs, the Sean Hannity shows, it's all a bunch of poppycock, of false hope.
Right, exactly.
Now, it doesn't mean that they're not articulate spokespersons for why a conservative approach to government is superior than a liberal approach to government. They're very knowledgeable on their perception of that. It's just that their remedy is nothing but false hope. And that's
exactly.
Not good. It's a bad thing.
Well, that's like you said, and I said that because of the way you start your show. You know, that it cannot be fixed.
Can't be fixed.
And that people will accuse you of being, you know, dismal. And it's like, no. God has provided a fire exit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's it. There's only one way out, you know.
Yes.
I'm not saying this to be dismal.
Right.
I'm saying this to get to keep you from wasting your time, effort, and worry on something that cannot work. And to point you to something that can work.
Right. But it's important to let people know that the building of government, of the military, of religion is being consumed by flames. It is literally collapsing in slow motion around the people.
Exactly.
so that they get out. And then that's half of the job, is getting them to question and then exit these the institution of religion, of politics, of militarism, of patriotism, is for them to recognize that those institutions are ablaze, that they were built on faulty foundations, they are crumbling around them, start to question the way that they were constructed, and then go through the exit door. Now, that's half of the journey. But that first step is required for most people to be in a position, in fact, all people, to be in a position to take the next step, which is there is hope. It's just that the hope can't be found in government or religion. The hope is in the Torah. The hope is with the author of the Torah, Yahweh. And he has provided a singular doorway, an escape route, that leads to him and to his home and to everything that is worth having. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion about the fact that the whole world is being misled, that being given false hope. The fact is that political institutions, it doesn't matter what country you live in, they're rotten. Judicial institutions are failing. They're no longer just. The military, particularly America's, has been used to make bad situations worse. They have never assured American freedom. The very thing that patriotically that is ascribed to them is utter nonsense. Servicemen are committing suicide in record numbers as a result of the moronic missions that they have been sent on. Lose-lose scenarios that are still trumpeted as if they were great triumphs. Our politicians are promoting economic solutions for an economy that is already bankrupt, a country that's already bankrupt. But there is an answer, as Glenn has said. There is a singular path. One that Yahweh articulated in his Torah thousands of years ago. Now, you'd think that if the world was all degrading, just as God said, and particularly, you know, as we share the 17th chapter of Yahshayah and consider what God had to say about the Syrian war, you'd think that people would look to him and say, oh, my goodness. This is a bad set of circumstances. Is there a way out? Why do you think so few people look, Glenn?
There's ignorance. There's willful ignorance. There's really malicious willful ignorance. You know, fear, just not not actually desiring to know and do truth. I mean, what can you say? We're
sinners. You know what Yahweh said in the prophet, through the prophet Hosea about ignorance?
My people perish for lack of knowledge. Is that the one you're talking about? Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that'd be the one. Yeah. My people perish for lack of knowledge. Ignorance isn't bliss, according to God. If you are unaware of who he is, of what he has said, of the guidance and path that he has provided, you're going to die. And you're going to stay that way. That's God's position on all of this. And yet, God made the answer so readily available. Glenn, I'm stunned that there are so few people who are articulating who God is and what he had to offer.
I was meaning to broach that topic with you.
Yes.
Because that's what that's what a contrarian might say. You know,
right.
It's like, boy, fishing, God didn't get himself a good Madison Avenue ad man to send me this message a little better.
Right. Yeah. And he would say that certainly if what we were saying here were true, that you would expect lots more people to say it, and you'd find people lots more qualified than I am articulating it with a much larger platform. So how is it possible that what we're saying about God is true if there's so few people saying it, and the individual, I won't speak for you, but I'll speak for me, is so admittedly unqualified?
Myself too, but I mean, well, even relative to what we know, I mean, I've spoken about the problem of syncretism, you know, about mm-hmm. even as a Christian having awareness of this adulteration, you know, and dilution,
right.
You know, and of the message and everything. And yet we have a tendency to just embrace or resist the notion like, okay, if I'm going to follow Jesus or Yahusha, how come I'm not doing what he did? You know, why am I celebrating the Mass or the Eucharist or communion instead of the Passover? Why am I worshiping on Sunday instead of observing the Sabbath? You know, to me, if the Sabbath made the Big Ten, you know, it's like, wait a minute.
Made the top 10 list, right?
And I just had this discussion with a friend the other day, and the resistance to the fact that, well, maybe we should try and say his name right. You know, it's just amazing. You know, the initial, there's just this horrific inertia to resisting the notion that maybe we should be calling God Yahweh.
And I think, Glenn, it gets back to the exact same thing, is that most people find it easier to cling to opinions and to believe than to investigate, think, and understand. It takes effort to investigate. It takes effort to think. It takes effort to understand. You early on realized that Christianity was an amalgamation of Babylonian pagan festivals and beliefs and edicts. It's an absolute fact. It is wholly and completely undeniable. But what do you do about that? If the religion has lied to you about every aspect of the religion, everything in the religion is a lie, when along the way do you say, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't be part of this religion anymore? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It seems just so reasonable, so logical, so obvious that one would take the time to determine whether the only document that can rationally be attributed to God, which would be the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is in fact trustworthy. I mean, it just seems reasonable that as you look around the world and it's all degrading, that you would see, did this God demonstrate that he actually exists? And if he did, how did he do so? Does the resulting text demonstrate that a supernatural being, apart from the constraints of time, authored this material? Is the material reasonable? Is it rational? Does it offer a solution? Is there, as you said, an escape door? And it just seems so utterly reasonable that you would go there to determine whether or not these things are true. And that when you go there, the first thing you would do is say, you know, these translations are all different. Maybe what I really need to do to determine whether or not this stuff is reasonable is to purchase some lexicons and interlinears and tackle this material to find out what it really does say. And then maybe I should invest a little more and see what are the oldest manuscripts and how do the oldest manuscripts differ from the basis of these translations. And spend a little time there. Wouldn't that seem like a logical, rational, reasonable approach to you, Glenn?
Yes, but it's also for those literate enough and trained enough and receptive enough to understand how to pursue those efforts. I'm thinking there's got to be a way for people with less
time.
But
wait a minute, Glenn. I'm not trained. I'm not particularly literate. My education in school was in business. You know, I went to business school. I have never taken a class ever on any foreign language, much less Hebrew. I have, when I went to school, unfortunately, I was amongst the first test where they pulled out phonetics. And I'm going to tell you, Grandma, I loved math. I love science. Man, math and science and I were bosom buddies. But when it came to grammar, man, I didn't get it. I was a complete and utter failure when it comes to grammar. And my worst grades in school were always in English and writing. I mean, it's important that our listeners know I'm nobody special in this regard. I am not qualified to do what I set out to do. The only two things that Glenn, I think were necessary. Maybe there's three that were necessary to be able to take the most logical and reasonable approach, which is to find out, you know, is there a God? Did he reveal himself to us in a credible way? Did he prove his existence? And does he explain what he's offering so that we can capitalize on it? Is first a willingness to invest the time. Most people are ignorant, which means unaware, not knowing, because they're unwilling to invest the time. It's not a priority to them. So it's got to be a priority. You've got to be willing to invest the time. Okay, so that's unique. God, in fact, I'm going to tell you, God deliberately makes it difficult in this regard. Now, difficult, I don't mean difficult of you got to be smart. That's not the case. I don't mean difficult in the sense he's trying to hide. That's not the case at all.
But requiring an investment of effort.
Absolutely. Makes it difficult in the sense that if you're not willing to invest the effort to focus on it, to prioritize it, you're never going to come to know him. And he wants it that way. And I think he wants it that way because of a number of reasons, one of which is that's what we're going to be doing in eternity. We're going to be spending time together investigating and learning and growing and sharing and exploring. And if that stuff isn't fun for you, if that stuff is stuff you're not willing to do, then you're going to be a real drag on the eternal party. So I think that's part of it. You've got to be willing to invest the time. I was. Now, the second thing is that what you're going to discover is so grossly divergent from everything you've been told to believe. And so when you find God saying, consistently saying the antithesis of what you've been told politically and religiously and militaristically and economically, you name it, when everything you hear from him is the opposite of what we've been told to believe, how are you going to deal with that?
Well, yeah, I'm always careful. I'm in progress. I'm mm-hmm. willing to accept correction and change what I'm doing wrong and correct what I've mm-hmm. what I have wrong. But I'm not totally on the same page as you, and I'm not
I'm not, you know, even completely read through everything yet. So, and I'm not willing to be anybody's sycophant. So, uh-huh. For the moment, I hope you're, you know, you understand yeah. that. I can't just be totally in your amen corner, as it were. I'm still
not.
Know,
not to mention that amen is not the corner yeah, I'm in yeah, because yeah, amen is the name yeah. Of an Egyptian sun god.
See, I knew that years ago. Yes. I knew that years ago, and yet I've not gone to the effort to expunge that from my vocabulary.
Right. No, I'm not speaking of you here, and I know your position in this regard. What I'm saying is that for anyone, just generally, if we were to ascertain what the qualifications are, the requirements are for someone who is going to do the obvious, which is to check out what God said, to closely examine and carefully consider what he had to say. Did he reveal himself? Is the revelation credible? Can he be known? Did he prove his authorship of this material? And did he offer us a something that we could capitalize on? Is that because of what he has to say is so radically different than the popular viewpoint, the popular perception, popular opinions, popular religion and political pundits? Are you willing to embrace the change? Are you willing to go where the truth leads?
Right.
Most people aren't. Most people aren't. You are. You know,
almost anybody who experiences a conversion experience, I wanted to make this point a number of times.
Yes.
People will often say they change from one thing to another, and they say, well, I used to think that and believe this, but now I found that a truth, I believe this. And they may have gone from Catholicism to Islam or from Protestantism to
right.
Catholicism.
Right.
And my stance on that is, the mere fact that someone has changed doesn't prove that what they now believe is correct. It merely proves that humans are changeable.
Of course. My point wasn't changing just to be different. Yeah, my point was, are you willing to go where the evidence leads?
Absolutely, you know, yeah.
And that's a really important aspect of all of this. If you find that Yahweh's testimony is different than your religious beliefs, are you willing to reject your religious beliefs to accept what he has to say? And what I find is the vast, vast majority of people are not.
And this is why the solar phallic cultist syncretism is so dangerous. Even as a Christian a number of years ago, there are people out there writing about, they've had for, it's just a recurring phenomenon, writing about, saying that Christ is just a solar hero, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Christians need to get this separation between Yahusha and, the Christ mythology that has all this
right.
solar stuff in it.
Right.
Because I almost lost my moorings in Yahusha, the wrong name. This notion of, you have the atheists who are mystics saying, it's all just a solar hero, and they don't even realize.
Right. By the way, they're right. And they're wrong, and you know that. And I was down the same path too. I went from Christianity to being an agnostic, and I went to being an agnostic because I recognized there were way too many discrepancies in Christianity that I could not answer, that were clearly wrong, and so I just went to becoming an agnostic. And in the case of those who are scholars writing about how Jesus Christ is a solar myth based upon the solar deities of old, they're right. The Christian Jesus Christ is based upon the Tammuz and Ninus and Osiris and Bacchus and Dionysus, almost identical to the Dionysus cult. And so if you went off to prove that the Christian Jesus Christ is based upon a sun god, pagan sun god cult, it is extraordinarily easy to prove and impossible to disprove. But the problem is,
yet the people are believing in the man
right.
who is Messiah, Yahusha. You peel back the veneer of that covering and there's
right.
Yahusha.
But the problem with those who say such things is that their argument is against the religion, not against the individual. The individual, they don't know. The individual was overtly opposed to sun god cults, overtly opposed to religion. The individual could not be killed. The individual was a diminished manifestation of God, not the totality of God. It wasn't a second generation deity. Man can't kill God. God was not physically resurrected. All of the stuff that has been ascribed to him by religion is not ascribed to him by Yahweh. And so, I'll give you another example. I was confronted by atheist sites, which I used to read because I just enjoyed learning. And one of their arguments to prove that the Torah was invalid is that they claim that in the creation account, the sun was created after plants were populated the earth. And they said, so proof that it's fallacious is the fact that the sun had to precede plants, but the creation account has it the other way around. And so if you read what they have to say and the argument they made, you'd be saying, well, of course, yeah. And I've seen so many people pick up on that argument and say, it's just proof that the creation account is nothing but a fable. Now, when we turn to Shattering Myths, we'll talk about what actually occurred on the fourth day and how that presentation is not only accurate, but profoundly important. The difference between knowing and understanding. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. When an individual does the most reasonable thing, which is to examine closely, to carefully consider what God actually had to say, examples like the third and fourth day being out of order all of a sudden make sense. But they're not out of order at all. In fact, the atheist criticism is ignorant. It's irrational. God didn't say that he created the sun and the moon on the fourth day of creation. He said they became visible. They became a sign. And a sign is something very important of the Moed, which are the meeting times. God has seven of these invitations to meet with him. And he talks about how the greater and lesser lights, this conflict between Yahweh and the adversary would be manifest during this period of time. And so it is, it's a time when after the earth's surface cooled sufficiently that it was possible for plant life to begin. After the bombardments of asteroids and that were the most prevalent in the Earth's orbit were had impacted, and volcanic activity began to diminish somewhat. Well, the atmosphere was almost pure carbon dioxide at that period of time, carbon dioxide and nitrogen, I should say. At that time, God created plants. And these plants not only consumed the carbon dioxide, producing oxygen, but the amount of debris kicked up in the air from the volcanoes subsided, the amount of debris kicked up in the air from the asteroid impacts subsided, and ultimately a atmosphere that was occluded became transparent. The sun and the moon could be seen. That's what God said. And then he said his calendar is going to be based on both the sun and the moon. And it is. His year is a solar year, but with lunar months. And that those lunar months direct us to the meeting times. So when you actually know what happened, when you consider the words that he actually wrote, rather than being proof that it isn't credible, it's proof that it is immensely credible.
One would expect sort of a historical rabbinical school of thought that's in agreement with that. So is there a historical precedent for that? Or because you'll be accused of that being conjectural.
Yeah, no, because of the fact, and I can be accused of it, that's fine. But,
yeah.
You know, when you make a statement like that, that's a summary statement of what was discovered. The detailed analysis of that is found in Yada Yada. If our listeners will go to yadaya.com and you go to the first volume of that book called Haya, which means existence, and you read that, what you will find is very early on, it's probably in the third chapter, of that first volume of Yada Yada, you'll find exactly what God said, translated there for you, every word analyzed, and then the absolute proof for what I have just shared. It's God's testimony.
It explicitly does not say that God created them.
Explicitly does not say that the sun or the moon was created on the fourth day. He expressly says that they became visible as a sign, and a sign of the moed. It's the moed mikre. It's the God's invitations to be called out and to meet with Him on a particular schedule. That schedule is determined by moon phases within the solar year, and so God told us that this is what this day is about, as well as about the revelation of the greater light becoming visible to us. And so if you look historically at mankind in the fourth millennia after Adam and Chawa had been booted out of the garden, which would be year 4,000, 4,000 years after Adam and Chawa had been booted out of the garden, who appeared in our world?
Well, the first theophany of Yahusha, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, Yahusha, 33 CE. Yeah, 33 CE is year 4,000, And so the fourth millennium of human history, God appears as He said He was going to do, and He enables the promises of the covenant. And so in the fourth millennia of human history, expelled from the garden, the first four Mikra are enabled, the promises therein which fulfill all of the benefits of the covenant. It's exactly as He predicted it would be. We're back after the news and commercials.